Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's almost after the weekend, but it's during the international break, and therefore we're going to just be answering questions, talking a little bit about soccer affairs around the world. And I guarantee you some people have already turned off because I use that term, with Chris Hennage. Good to have you, Chris.
Good to be here.
And of course with Nico Morales, live from Orlando, Florida.
Live here from Adam Boltwood's future location.
Adam Boltwood indeed, although I'm not sure we're allowed to say this, is going to Orlando at some point. We can't tell you when or exactly where, but we think it'll be soon, and definitely one of the theme parks. He's that kind of guy. Anyway, it's the international break, and there's a lot of cool stuff going on there. So should we talk a little bit, guys, about what's going on just before recording tonight? England won 1-0 in the end, thanks to a very late Harry Kane winner. Not a particularly outstanding performance from England, but Chris, it means that they are now World Cup bound.
Yeah, and I think it was Daniel Storey that put the stat that they're unbeaten in 39 qualifiers or something mad like that.
Yeah.
Which is the longest record in the world. I mean, you could argue it's a microcosm or a great way to portray their issue, which is, you know, a comfortable qualification, but an atrocious tournament performance. I think, and I'm sure we'll get into this in greater depth at different points, but it was a very mediocre performance. And at that point, I think you have to criticise everyone. You criticise the players because I don't think they really know what they're doing as a team. They're all individuals. And you criticise Southgate because there was nothing about him to suggest that he would be this wonderful manager. And that statement has been, I think, reinforced by performance.
Yeah, it's a bit of an unusual, really, isn't it? Because you look at all of the ingredients in this England team and you think there should be something more there than they're currently putting together. But for some reason, because of the low expectations, maybe, what's going on is, it almost seems normal. There's an almost kind of placid acceptance of what's going on around England at the moment, which I find quite unusual, Chris, because, you know, they've got Harry Kane up front, who people are comparing excitedly to anyone who's, you know, above an 88 rating on FIFA. They've got the likes of, actually, this is a good one, Rashford. They've got, who else they have? They have Jordan Henderson in midfield, captain, of course, of Liverpool. They've got the young guys coming on, like Jess Lingard, who's obviously becoming more and more exciting for teams like Manchester United. They have Kyle Walker, they have Ryan Bertrand, they have John Stones, they have Eric Dyer. Obviously, Dele Alli is also somewhere in that squad. You know, it gets more exciting. And obviously, people like Daniel Sturridge and even Jermaine Defoe, I think, within this squad as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, it's not a bad collection of players. I sometimes think that's one of the misnomers about England, is that the standard or the quality has dropped since the days of Scholes and Ince and people like that. The difference is, and I saw a few people make the same point on Twitter, that when you actually watch them, it seems as if, firstly, there isn't a clear leader in that group. There isn't someone standing above the parapet taking control. And I think things like Kyle Walker taking an attacking free kick outside the box kind of highlight that, because it seems like everyone is trying to have that moment to do their thing. And so really, at that point, it does become 11 blokes that have just met in the car park. It's not a cohesive team in which player X has this role, player Y has that role. And that's where I think the confusion almost comes for fans and pundits alike, is this collection of players. It's clearly not a bad group of players because, you know, they influence the Premier League week on week. Yes, they're not always the greatest players in their teams, but they're influential. The difference is when they get together, it's not that the quality drops significantly. It's that I don't always think that they really know what they're doing and they understand what those around them are doing either. I think you look at Jordan Henderson's a good example of that. He's someone that doesn't, to me, have a clearly defined role.
I think Henderson is told to sort of move the ball very quickly and, you know, get into positions which are almost conservative. At least that's what it looks like. And then there's players ahead. I mean, he's also got Eric Dyer alongside him. It's sort of unusual because the problem for Henderson is he sort of has become the next generation of Owen Hargreaves, those sort of players where he doesn't do... I mean, he does a lot of things to a very good level and could do something exceptionally, but has never been deployed in that way.
Yeah, and I think... watching Raheem Sterling as well tonight, I thought, and I must confess, I only really saw the most of the first half and little bits of the second half. I thought he looked very lost. And I think, I think in general, to be quite frank, playing him against a team like Slovenia, who are going to sit very deep, who are going to stay compact, I'm not sure what the benefit is there, because Sterling is someone that's going to want to run at people, and there's just not space for him to run into. So very often he was getting it in central areas and being swarmed and trying to dribble his way out of trouble and just turning over the ball. So it's things like that I find a little bit bizarre. And I mean, you could extrapolate that out even further. I think you look at someone like Jonjo Shelvey, who was talked about as maybe, if the stars align, if he keeps consistent, being a member of the England squad, and the looks of derision that followed that. I personally don't think that that's a terrible suggestion, because I don't think really there's anyone, maybe bar Danny Drinkwater, that offers the kind of skills that he's got. And too often I do think we look at it a little bit like name brand shopping and say, okay, well, we have to have Henderson and Dyer in there because they're great.
I agree.
But do they complement what we need?
It seems like Gareth Southgate is picking players who can play weirdly in a sort of pass and move system on a very basic level. Nico, I know you didn't watch it tonight, but I mean, you know, there's a difference to Raheem Sterling this season. The confidence that he exudes when he plays for Manchester City is something which is very exciting for not only England fans, but probably just fans watching the Man City project evolving. And then he goes and plays for England and suddenly it looks like he doesn't have those options on. And someone tweeted tonight, but they said, you know, funny how, Sterling suddenly doesn't look as good when he plays for England. And I thought, well, no one's really given him the options that he normally gets at Man City, are they? You know, no one seems to be making those kind of movements. And it's unusual because actually, I know we talk about some of the team's parts, but it's almost like when you put these guys together and you don't give them a system to fit into, then, I don't know, something... They almost get sapped of their inspiration when they seem to go on the England tour. Or maybe what's unusual is we've taken out of the English press the sort of very barbed criticism that most people used to go for. And we've sort of gone for a more veiled passive aggression towards England, or even apathy, which at this point it really doesn't help the team.
Yeah, I mean, I think... a lot of what you guys are saying is correct, and the difficulty with the English squad, I think in particular, is exactly that, in the sense that Chris mentioned, that he said, you know, it is almost like 11 individuals, and to some extent I think Gareth Southgate has an extremely difficult job, because a lot of these really talented players like Raheem Sterling and Dele Alli and different guys from Chelsea and Tottenham and Manchester City and Manchester United, they're all doing things that are in their systems that are extremely different from a tactical perspective. So the coolest thing that I've seen from Raheem Sterling and the greatest evolution of his game, I think that I've seen as a Manchester City fan, is the fact that he's being used more centrally, sort of as a almost exclusively as an off-ball player in some games, where he, you know, Pep Guardiola is using his intelligence, and that's really what he saw in the player in the first place, was his ability to make intelligent runs through the middle of the park, and his quickness and his you know, fast passing ability accentuates those qualities are accentuated by the Manchester City system. You know, you have wide players that Raheem Sterling maybe isn't so much of anymore, and he can make a greater impact centrally. But then when he joins the English national team, I think a lot of the time people only see him as that winger that can put in a cross, and they only see certain players doing certain things, where, you know, in their club teams and their club systems, they're being used to, you know, so much different roles than they are in the national team, and that Gareth Southgate can use them in the national team. So in that sense, I think also the national team struggles from, you know, the very thing that someone like Antonio Conte, in charge of the Italian national team, got right, is the thing that the national team gets wrong, because they're not taking, oftentimes they're not taking the 22 or 24, 26 best individuals. They're taking the best group of individuals that can, you know, perpetuate a tactical idea in a tournament where you need to have things down pat before you even go. And I think oftentimes they can, you know, we need one player from Everton, we need one player from Manchester United, because there's this like sense of we need a representation of our club in the national team, when it's never a good team of people.
That is interesting, isn't it, Chris? I mean, Nico has maybe said something that a lot of English people are failing to see right now, which is that this is a team that feels very much like it's built like by some sort of beige committee. And maybe it's because we see the representation of that committee as Gareth Southgate at the very top. But what Conte did was have a very bold philosophy, a very inspiring idea. And it gave the players, when they went on international duty, something very clear and defined that they knew they had to fit into. Whereas it seems very much for Gareth Southgate as if when the players go away for, and again, I've not been inside the camp, so I don't know, but from the end product, what we're seeing is something which almost looks as if he's sort of saying, well, you know, how can we meld all these players together? It doesn't look as if and I can't just put this on Gareth Southgate, because there's a big coaching team for England and obviously even wider analysts, but sets of people saying like, well, you know, we need these guys to do their magic. You know, it needs, I think, Nico, you were tweeting the other day about moments which can set us apart. And ultimately, again, it came down to, again, one of those moments where you can see it coming out of, you know, an Ian Wright's mouth or someone like that saying, well, it was a moment of magic, wasn't it, Ian? Well, it was a moment of magic, yeah, Adrian, and it was a fantastic moment. And you know, he's been making these moments for ages, and then we just sort of get into the same old analysis.
Yeah, and I think maybe just to speak to that, I think people that we hear the phrase that, you know, a player is confident, right? And I think the most consistent thing that I hear from players that are interviewed about their experience with Pep Guardiola is that they are confident in their ability and they're secure in the job that they need to do for the team, because Guardiola in his training sessions is so meticulous, and the consistency that I hear is that, you know, we know exactly what we need to do in every situation on the field. If you are given a very direct and understood game plan, every single player on the pitch is, as you go out there, then there's no reason for you to feel uncomfortable in high pressure situations, because you've been mapped out by the very person that's supposed to be telling you what to do in those situations. And I think that's part of the coaching philosophy that he implements so well, is that these players can be confident in their ability to do things because they understand what to do, as opposed to, and maybe different coaching methods work with different players, and other players can survive or thrive with more freedom in what they're allowed to do. But I often feel like, so for example, I think in the past year, or maybe in the World Cup or in the Euros, like it was, like you said, it's a beige committee. It's like, okay, well, we have to play Kane, Sturridge and Rooney because we can't exclude any of them, but it doesn't make any sense to play all of those players at the same time. It's like they're afraid to drop these players because they need this sense of representation, when in actuality, maybe some of them don't even belong to, they don't need to be there. Not that they're not good enough to be part of the squad, but there is a more clear and cohesive idea from the players that you can gather to make a counterattacking team. And maybe you just take Kane and Vardy. And maybe you just play one of them in certain situations. It's a sense like there's no coherent idea because people don't want to side with one club. Because if they do, then it's like, oh, well, are they biased? Are they going with, you know, the experiences that they had in their career? It's just so backwards, and people are afraid to come across with the genuine idea that you see them going out to Iceland, that you see them going on the group stage.
There is something that seems fairly clear to just around this, again, sort of Beijing-England conversation off. Chris, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain started for England tonight. Last night, whenever you're listening, people said this is a great opportunity for him to prove himself. And he had a bad game. He kicked a bottle when he went off. Didn't particularly make the impact that maybe he would have wanted to. Mind you, not many England players did against Slovenia. But it might show that Gareth Southgate is going on somewhat of the merits of what he looks for in a player, rather than the form or, you know, the sort of the reputation that people come with. Because it's quite clear right now that Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's reputation is very much sort of a negative one, at least in London, where there's a lot of Arsenal fans kind of, you know, oh, they've won a lot of games since he left, as if he was the only sole factor in that happening before anyway.
I think it was Capello that said form didn't influence his selections, which I think is a maddening way to look at things. By the same token, I'm not an advocate of calling up someone just because they're performing. I think, again, it has to go back to are they a good fit with what you're trying to do on the rest of the field? And then are they also in form? I'm not really sure which one of those.
But surely he's assessing that.
I would wholeheartedly disagree with that.
Surely he's assessing. I mean, surely if he starts Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain is coming to training, and Gareth Southgate's either having a chat with him and saying, for some weird reason, you're my number one guy out on the, you know, right wing or whatever. Maybe he sees him as the sort of the right side of a central midfield, something like that. And he says, you know, go out there and do what you're doing in training. And then maybe there's some sort of mental game block there for Alex Oxlade, because that's what it seems to look like. A lot of people seem to rate him. A lot of people say he's a great trainer. He's a great guy to have around. But if he's a great guy to have around, then Pepe Reina him and put him as the third choice goalkeeper. Do you know what I mean? Because it doesn't seem like, it's not like playing with 10 men, but it looks from the outside like an unusual decision.
It is, of course it is. I think that's the problem, is that for a long time you could survive in the England squad because of where you were playing rather than how you were playing. Okay. And I think that's an issue that still dogs the national team now. I remember many years ago when Jordan Henderson was playing up at Sunderland, I thought then he was good enough to get a look in, but he didn't. There are players, I think, throughout the years. I think if Jamie Vardy doesn't win the Premier League, I don't think he has England caps to his name. Mm-hmm. And yet you would argue he's been one of the more consistent performers during the last 18 months in an England shirt.
It's not a terrible point.
I think the one time they've looked actually not only cohesive but actually quite exciting is that half an hour against Germany before Euro 2016. And in that period, he is a big part of that, Vardy. It's his performance that stands out for
that's
me.
That's what's weird.
So
that's why that didn't excite me at all. Partly because Jamie Vardy was one of the more exciting players in that.
I think that's the problem. You look at that 30-minute period, and it sounds almost criminal to deem that as if it's in any way acceptable. That is the period where England have looked most sure of what they're trying to do. And that's, you could argue that's equally exciting as it is concerning, because they haven't gone back to that. If anything, they've deviated from it quite consistently.
Yeah, well, England find themselves qualified for the World Cup. So they have a long time now to work and maybe to test. And maybe that's partly why they've put this squad together with the likes of Winks, etc., etc. So they can maybe show those guys off. Of course, they have another fixture. But there are plenty of other fixtures also to discuss. Germany also thrashed, I want to say, Northern Ireland 3-1. In Northern Ireland, they almost have completely the opposite sort of situation to the situation that we find ourselves in in England. There's elsewhere, though, there is problem, or at least trouble, Chris, for Portugal. They find themselves on the verge of not going through. Argentina, arguably much bigger problems as well for them. And, of course, USA.
Yeah, USA, I would, I mean, yeah, I would say, so USA are in the playoffs, I believe Portugal are also in the playoffs. Argentina have a really crunch game against Peru Thursday night. So as you listen to this, that'll have been decided and you'll have a better grasp on how things are going. Peru are taking absolutely no risks, though. They're bringing their own water because they don't want it to be tampered with. I think they had armed guards blocking training so no one could spy on them, because Peru have a decent chance of going to the World Cup themselves, and I think I'm saying this obviously before it kicks off, I think they're going to try and go for a point. I don't think they're going to try and take all three, so it's I mean, it's crazy to think that theoretically the countries associated with the two best players in the world could potentially not be at the tournament if things go a little bit awry for them.
Yeah, it is a little bit unusual, isn't it, that sort of the excitement of both those players right now being taken away from, because, well, neither of them might be there. But yeah, let's see where it goes. Anyway, let's talk a little, obviously, about Pascal Chimbonda.
Yes, from the heights of international football all the way down to, I think it's amateur football. I'm going to say, yeah, I think it's like amateur and non-league. He signed for Washington FC, which is, Washington is a small town in Sunderland, or in the shadow of Sunderland. And yeah, it's actually a place I used to live. I grew up there for about 5 or 6 years, so I know it fairly well. I'm still not fully grasping why he chose to sign for them. He was at Carlisle for a little bit before he went back to France to play for Arles Avignon. But even then, it's an hour and 20 drive to Carlisle from Sunderland. Or from Washington, excuse me. So, yeah, I'm really not sure on this. I'd be quite curious to ask him what is motivating a 38-year-old to play at a very low level of football. Maybe he just wants to stay fresh. But credit to whoever put the announcement together, because they've introduced him as the new singing.
Oh, God. Have they really?
Yeah, unfortunately.
That's embarrassing, isn't it? Good guys, but a lot of people do that, though, don't they? People get excited, they type in the moment, they don't double check it. It's embarrassing. How old is he now?
38.
So still sort of, yeah,
not decrepit.
Yeah, that's not something to put in your CV, is it? 38.
More than you, not decrepit.
Not decrepit. Yeah, but those of you who remember him from, well, I suppose the highest profile club he's been to is Spurs, wasn't it?
Yeah, he first came to prominence with Wigan. He was signed from Bastia for, I think it was £500,000. Then famously left Wigan. Wigan, I believe, they weren't relegated, but the last day of the season they played at Highbury. I think they were the last ever team to play at Highbury against Arsenal. And he had a transfer request written on a piece of paper in his shin guard, or behind his shin guard. So as soon as they went in the changing rooms, Jimmy Bollard tells the story that he took the transfer request out, gave it to Paul Jewell, and the rest is history.
Wow. He could have just left it in the locker, obviously. Weirdly, he sort of carried it around him with him for the full match, I guess.
Yeah, I can't imagine that was too comfortable. I mean,
how long's a transfer request?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if our listeners will remember Facundo Sava.
No, Chris, they won't.
He was a striker that played for Fulham briefly, and he used to carry a mask in his underwear or in his shorts. And I always used to think that must be really uncomfortable to play with.
Didn't someone used to do it with Fulham?
That's exactly who I'm talking about.
No. I thought it was someone else. No, it wasn't. His name wasn't Sava, was it?
I'm convinced it was Facundo Sava. Let me just triple check.
I'm pretty sure. I always thought it was some sort of Nordic player, something like that.
No, I'm looking at it now. Yeah, it used to have a mask, black and white mask he would put on. Zorro-esque.
Yeah, it was Zorro-esque. Fulham mask.
And obviously, Jonas Gutierrez used to carry a Spider-Man mask in his shorts.
Yeah. Makes sense. All makes sense now. Fulham mask is what I've just typed, but I fear I'm going to bring up the wrong things. Probably not. And at this point, it's almost irrelevant. Let's just stop the podcast just there for 1 second. We have a sponsor, obviously, for the weekend previews. There's no preview this week, but obviously the Q&As are sponsored by Fan League. And obviously, if you guys want to go and play Fan League, it's fantastic. There's an app on the App Store. I've played it. I've played it on friends' phones as well. Chris, have you played Fan League?
I have. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is a predictor app, essentially, and that's what's great about it. You can go, you can join a few different leagues, and you can essentially get a pot of... there's a pot of money in the middle that you can win a share of, dependent upon your results, or a massive share of. And there are big pots of money there to win. And obviously, whatever goes into it, or this is actually a really good thing. 10% of any revenue Fan League make goes to grassroots football. And obviously, you can win, and other people can win through you sort of getting on the app and starting to do that. So not only are you sort of helping yourself, you're also going to be helping grassroots football. And the more people that you add into your own group, and obviously our group as well, the bigger the amount of help that we can offer Fan League, and obviously therefore grassroots football. I think we've done pretty well so far on the podcast. We've sort of gotten, I think we got 8 out of 13 in the first week, 9 out of 13 at some point. Some people I know got 11
out of 13.
We got 10 out of 13. Wow. Which actually, it's not terrible. It sort of shows how well we could do if we keep sort of going with this one, and how it isn't just sort of blind luck. Although those three we might say we got 3 wrong out of 13. You guys obviously can go and join us on there as well. You can find our league on there. Plus, we've also been asked to promote the £1,000 competition that's being run through Fan League as well. So you've got a chance to win quite a share of money in there. If you guys can beat us, we'd be interested to know. Of course, you have to be on the app in order to do so. Nico, you can't play along. But I think when you're in the UK, you then can. So when you do come over later in the year... I'll be more than happy to enter you into the league once you're in the UK, as long as that is, of course, legal and not breaking any rules.
Of course. Yeah. Excited and looking forward to doing that.
Great. Go to the App Store, or I think we include a link in the description of the podcast. It's Fan League. It's simple. It's fun. And it's good on the weekends. So enjoy it. Come along. Join the front three on there. You can join our league and you'll have a great chance of winning a share of a lot of money in there as well. Just come along, have fun with us, and enjoy. That's Fan League. Back to the podcast. And Nico, we thought it'd be interesting to sort of chat between us about getting little updates on people who are around Europe at the moment. Let's start in the Premier League. Any updates on Man City at this point? Like, let's sort of do a quick checkup on them. Feeling good about them?
Yeah, I think this is really the season defining period for them, because obviously with the injury to Benjamin Mendy and only really one fully fit left back, Danilo really only a placeholder there, more of a right center back or a right back fill-in, or backup rather. I think this winter period will honestly be the defining moment for them. If Guardiola can get through that period without any more injuries, and you know, with positive results across the competitions that they want to succeed in, which is usually, you know, the Premier League and the Champions League, I think this is really where they show whether they're going to be champions or trophy holders or not at the end of the season. So I would say that this, as opposed to the latter stages of the season, is more important.
Mm. That's interesting. I mean, I genuinely I still think there's a lot to go on, obviously, and this is a lot of games still to go. And at this point in the season, I think last time didn't... I mean, it's something along the lines of Man City obviously hadn't really stumbled yet.
the right around now is when they were stumbling last season. So they play, they won 10 in a row across all competitions, and then they stumbled at Celtic, I think, with a 3-3 draw. And then they lost to Spurs 2-0, and they lost 6 in a row. And it was sort of up and down from then on. And I think I guess the more period ahead. So like November, December-ish period. I think in that time where kind of everybody's almost playing three times a week across all the different competitions with the maybe lack of depth that they have at their more important positions behind. That's really where the difficulty is. And I've spoken about that in the last podcast with the changes that he's made with Fabian Delph and how he offers something different. It's obviously not like for like to Benjamin Mendy because he was such an offensive fullback and could offer that athleticism up and down the pitch. He really comes more inside and acts as a central midfielder to try to get the best out of Leroy Sané. But you know, you don't want to play your most hectic period in schedule with only one player in a certain position, especially one that's as key to the system as fullback for Pep Guardiola. So it'll be the sort of game of rotation and tactical changes to put different players in those positions to try to share the minutes so that we try to get as few injuries as possible and sort of make it through the period without better teams sort of figuring us out tactically.
Wow. Well, there's a lot certainly going on. Chris, one team I'm certainly interested in at this point in the season is Chelsea. Chelsea find themselves obviously no one really finds themselves that far off the top of the table at this point. But if you look at maybe the perception of where Chelsea are right now after the tricky loss to Man City, they're only 6 points off the top. And arguably one of the bigger challenges, just 1 point behind, I think they're 1 point behind Spurs at this point in the league. Do you think that with Alvaro Morata up front and maybe some January signings, they can retain the title?
To me, it feels like the title is won by the team that maintains its momentum. And I think the fact that Morata is potentially injured, which means you're going to have to now rely on Batshuayi for a little bit. The squad itself, I think it could be deeper. That's an issue I have as well. Obviously, Jeremy Boga has come in and played the opening day defeat to Burnley. But I would say outside of that, he's an unknown quantity in the Premier League. He had his moments with Granada. He was quite direct, quite aggressive, a good carry of the ball. But you don't know what he's going to be like playing for Chelsea. I'm certainly not going to rule them out because that would be madness. But I think if I was having to put money down on each team, I'd probably put a lot less on Chelsea, just because I do think that with everything they've got going on, with more competitions, with a smaller squad, I don't see where that momentum is really coming from at this stage. I mean, saying that, you could easily apply a lot of those statements to last season as well, because I think that winning run that they had that was so influential in getting them the title did really come from nowhere.
Mm. No, I mean, relatively nowhere, obviously, with everything that's gone up before that. But yeah, I see your point. Let's go to Bundesliga, where there's a 6-point gap, obviously, Nico, between Dortmund and Bayern. Bayern are doing... 5-point
gap. What? 5-point gap.
5-point gap. Bayern find themselves in an unusual position with the sort of PR, that they're on the PR offensive at the moment, whilst trying to basically show that they aren't, and this is the way that most journalists are sort of portraying it, a team which is currently split into factions in the dressing room and also aging in maybe some of the wrong areas.
Yeah, and I think it's obviously they usually, especially in the past few seasons with Pep Guardiola, they usually don't find themselves within the position of being second to a dominant Borussia Dortmund team at any stage in the season, really. And it was funny because, you know, we have a great listener fan base that's really diverse in sort of the teams that they support. And I know we have quite a few Dortmund fans. So I asked one of them if maybe if they won the title this season, if it would mean anything less to them, considering this was a year where Bayern weren't really, you know, at the races as they usually are. And he said no, he would enjoy the title all the same because, you know, a title's a title, and Bayern have messed up in other areas, and that's, you know, it's sort of this, it's still within, you know, the competition of running a club. And so at the same time, sort of within that train of thought. I think it's a really strange decision to go back to Jupp Heynckes. It kind of smells of Nagelsmann next summer. But it's strange because, you know, his treble winning Bayern team was probably one of my favorites.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Favorite teams to watch because they were so dynamic, they were so physical, and they destroyed Tito Villanova's Barcelona team in the Champions League, and that was such a great moment to watch after that team had dominated Europe for a number of years. But you know, he's 71 years old, I think, so it's quite old for being a manager, and he's been out of the game for a while, and I think it's one of those skills that does tend to deteriorate having not been in the game for a while. So it'll be interesting to see how they got on in this period, but obviously they have the break, so maybe that will aid them in sort of getting his ideals through as opposed to Carlo Ancelotti's.
I certainly heard a lot of interesting things. I think Bayern have rushed to the players' aid rather than trying to maintain some sort of dignity when sacking a manager. It certainly does seem like an unusual thing for Bayern to do. It doesn't look great for them right now. It didn't look great for them. And you sort of think the next manager, all he really has to do is run some training sessions and give them some sort of rigidity or something to fashion the team around. But let's see. Let's talk a little bit about Serie A, Chris. Napoli and Sarri just look dreamlike sometimes. It is genuinely the best football in Europe.
It is. And I think for me personally, what makes it more interesting is his own backstory. I know that the team gets a lot of the focus, but I kind of like that, you know, he's spent years and years and years and years building to this point, that he's not a product of professional football. He was, I think he worked in a bank.
He was a banker up until he was 40 years old.
And so this is a little bit of a later in life pursuit for him, and yet he's able to produce this football. He's made Dries Mertens one of the most devastating forwards in European football, even though for the longest point he was a winger. And I mean, you know, I saw bits of him for PSV Eindhoven, less so for Utrecht. At no point did I see this level of production from Dries Mertens, let's put it that way. And I think when I watch them, again, more from a personal standpoint, I just really appreciate Jorginho in midfield. I appreciate that the likes of Hamsik and Callejon and those players may get the headlines, but I think if you're looking for a midfielder who can pass between lines and spot avenues with which to squeeze the ball through, then I think you're really hard pressed to look past him because he's just so good at it. And again, much like the coach, he's not someone that's come via a hugely illustrious pathway. If anything, he's, you know, from Verona to Napoli, it's really not a huge starting point for his career.
Nico, you're obviously a big fan of what they're doing there as well.
Yeah, it's probably been some of the best football for a year now, and people are kind of catching on to that, and it's really good to see that everybody can appreciate that. But not only that, but you know, they do have a nice little 3-point cushion on the usual champions, Juventus.
I was going to say that is sort of the difference at this point, isn't it? Is that obviously they were in the chasing pack before, whereas obviously now that they're the leaders.
Yeah, and sort of, you know, being within the journalistic sphere of it, when certain things happen, like you kind of just headline just kind of fly into your head. And they recently won 3-2 against a very small team off the coast. I think it was an island team in Italy that had been promoted to the first division due to some very good management with. I think the acronym SPAL is sort of their team name, and they won 3-2 by their left back Goulam scoring a brace, and it was absolutely fantastic. And it's those sort of moments that if they do end up winning the title this season, it's those sort of games where SPAL had scored two goals against them in the most unusual of circumstances, like a crazy free kick and then a mistake from one of the Napoli defenders, and it was 2-2 up until sort of the dying breaths of the game. And you have to imagine that Napoli, you know, beating some of the bigger sides in Serie A, that's, while they will do that this season, and actually all of the big boys in Serie A face off in the following weekend after the international break, which will be a critical moment in the season. But you have to imagine that if Napoli do win the title, it won't be in those big weekends. It'll be in weekends like that where they go to a very small stadium at Spal and win 3-2 in a deeply contested rainy night game where their left back scores a brace. I mean, I'm really excited to see the progression that they've made from being, like you said, part of the chasing pack to being champions. And I think it's deserved. You know, that they're probably one of the most fantastic teams to watch, no matter who they play, not necessarily because of the personnel that they have, but because of the way they play. So, you know, like I've, you know, waxed lyrically before about Sadio and Napoli, I will be doing again for The Ringer. So if you guys want to check that out, it will be up soon.
Certainly doing some good stuff over there. Chris, let's move on to Liga just for a minute. Obviously with Liga, we see PSG actually being challenged, obviously not only on the pitch by some of the great sides up at the top there, but also in terms of in the table as well, because, you know, there is a chasing pack, a set of people who want to take them or knock them off the perch, I guess would be a good turn of phrase to use.
Yeah, I mean, Monaco is still up there. It's nice to see Marseille up in third as well. I think that is good for French football. I mean, Lyon are closer to mid-table, which is not great and a little bit of a surprise to me in some ways, because I think there's a lot of talent in that team.
Nantes aren't really realistically going to challenge for the entire season, are they?
No, I think it's beautiful to see Ranieri succeeding again. It's a team that, while it does not concede goals, it doesn't really score goals either. Yeah. They've got the fewest goals scored of any team in the top half, and there's only actually, I think, two or three teams in the entire league that have scored less than them this season. So it's very basic football in that sense. But I think, yeah, the race or the excitement, if you're watching the French league, is Monaco and PSG. It's the very differing schools of approach on how to build a club. You know, that was the interesting switch from Monaco, was that, you know, mentality whereby they originally used to spend a boatload of money and then realized they couldn't. And Paris are the opposite now. They do spend an insane amount. But I think the continued resurgence of Falcao is always worth watching. And it'll likely come down to when they meet each other. I don't think it'll be settled on random weeks at other clubs. Although, saying that, I wasn't too impressed with PSG the last time I saw them.
Well, it's certainly been a bit of a journey for PSG. It looks less impressive. I guess in considering their demeanour and some of the other stuff that's gone on, but they are playing some great stuff at times on the pitch. Very often they're taking teams who maybe just don't seem as equipped as they do apart, which sort of, I don't quite understand the excitement of that. I guess if you do it in the Champions League, you know, maybe against a rebelling Bayern Munich side, there's something a bit more impressive with that. But even then, you sort of think, well, we'll see, I guess. Chris?
Sorry, what was the question?
Well, I mean, it was just more of a statement. You know, it's less impressive when they're... We've said this before on the podcast, and maybe people have sort of picked up on the fact that we don't think Liga is quite as competitive as some other leagues. But you know, it does feel a little less impressive because it's PSG and sort of the money and all those sort of things, and maybe the way, or maybe also the way they've conducted themselves over the summertime, and apparently PSG also said when Barcelona or were going through the whole are still going through the whole Catalonia situation, they said they wouldn't be welcome in the league.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's the problem, is the PSG spending is cast alongside the fact that clubs in France, for the most part, don't have a lot of money to spend. They have, in my opinion at least, been selling clubs. And so it almost leaves a sour taste in the mouth because it feels so ostentatious, the level of spending. The fact that, you know, it wasn't just Neymar, they've bought Mbappe as well, who I know they don't have to pay for now, but still, it's close to £500 million worth of attack, yeah. Which is just, it probably feels a little bit sickening when you have to play them and you realise that your team probably didn't even cost half of one of those players.
I suppose it's also an incredible challenge, but then, yeah, there are other aspects to that. Let's move on to arguably two of the biggest teams in Europe right now, hashtag United and Tekkers Town. They meet in a friendly on Saturday, 3 o'clock at Wembley Stadium, UK. Chris, this is incredibly exciting as a tie for you, because you know and have watched so many of the people in this game for you. And it is actually, I guess it is, in terms of YouTube, I'm sort of being a little bit sarcastic there, but you know, it is an exciting tie for a lot of people who are maybe excited about the future of football and maybe what the likes of hashtag United, Tekkers Town and this sort of thing prove in terms of fan interaction and sort of involving people more directly in the pitch, you know, and what goes on and off it.
Well, that and the fact that one of my best mates is commentating.
I didn't realise you liked Brian so much, but all right.
I mean, it's great to see him succeed as well, you know, given what he's come from and what he's made of his career. I think he's done tremendously well. There was an interesting conversation I had in the summer, actually, or was it the summer? Yeah, I think it was the summer, about hashtag and the way that their increased growth has kind of evolved the demands or the expectations of their fan base. So I think now you have a fan base that looks at hashtags games through much more of a critical and analytical lens, in so much as they'll watch the game and they'll say, you know, Spencer, I think you did really well here, but I think you should have done this here.
Yeah.
Or have you considered switching to a 3-5-2? Whereas I think before, and I know Spencer's talked about the influences on this whole endeavour, the fashion FCs and those kind of things. I think without him trying or without him pushing it in that direction necessarily, it has become as close to a professional endeavour as you're going to get without them being in an official league, because the supporters now, or the followers, whichever adjective you want to apply, now view it as that. They view it as a team that, even if they don't have an investment in financially, they still are able to contribute, have an opinion on, just as if they were watching a Liverpool game or a Man United game.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, actually. And it's all very much more evidently constructed. So there's a lot, there's a lot more of a constructive feel around it, because obviously people have to organise games in a very different way to the way they do in the Premier League, and every one of these teams that's put together will have a bit of a different construction, and obviously Tekkers Town is no different. But those guys are the F2 leading that. There's legends on both teams as well. There's defender, midfielder, and striker in each side. It just turned out that way. Honestly, I was there filming when they won the legends for both teams, and it just so happened that they both got a defender, a midfielder, and a striker. It was interesting. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because obviously, both of these teams and both sets of players, you wouldn't, if you're a conventional football fan, you wouldn't necessarily have the interest in either. But there is an interesting factor as well, Chris, is sort of seeing normal people play in such a high pressure game. And when I say normal people, I mean someone that's not a professional athlete in that sense.
Yeah, I think to watch them be put through a lot of the sort of infrastructure, if you will, that the professionals get to sample. I think that makes for an interesting experiment in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a huge element of this that I think, depending on your perspective, is either envious or kind of congratulatory to the fact that whether the legends remember this game for the rest of their lives or not, for those playing alongside them, this will be a huge life event for them. This is people they've grown up with, and I defy anyone who would be presented that opportunity to turn it down, because it is a once in a lifetime experience. And I see why it means so much to all those involved, because not just in the digital age, I think personally, you want to be able to go to sleep at night and think, you know, I gave everything I could to that game and did everything I could. It's fitting that it's called the Wembley Cup, because to me it is. It's a cup final in so many ways. Even if it's not a tournament like the FA Cup or whatever, it still has a lot of the permutations, I think, in terms of legacy and things like that.
Yeah, certainly is an interesting one. Nico, do you have any views? I mean, have you seen any of the Wembley Cup series?
I have not, unfortunately. But it sounds really exciting. So I'm excited. I think I didn't keep track of it last year, but obviously I'm excited to support you and Brian, who did some great work last year as well. And it's going to be fun to watch.
Thank you. Any predictions, Chris? Because obviously when we get to the Wembley Cup this year, we've got Hashtag United, who were not there last year. It was Spencer's constructed team against, I think it was Weller Wanderers last year. And this year, of course, they're against Tekkers Town, which is a team put together by the F2. And they've got, I think they've got three great legends in there. Stephen Gerrard's playing in their midfield. Emil Heskey's up front. They've definitely got a defender. I can't remember who. But they've definitely got a defender in there. So it's going to be interesting. Sorry, they've got David James. So he's sort of a defender, I guess.
I think that's the thing in predicting it. I think the interesting thing is the difference in both teams. So, and I think Spencer has spoken to this end before, that for him, the hashtag have the cohesiveness, the understanding, the momentum, if you will, of playing together as a team and knowing how certain players like the ball, the little nuances that comes with team play. Whereas I would say the F2, there's an unpredictable element with them. I think if you watch, might be the first Wembley Cup, I think it's fair to say that Jeremy and Billy, obviously Billy won't be playing sadly, but Jeremy and Billy really did run the show and kind of had a lot of fun during that game, and their quality shone from pretty much start to finish. It's the kind of moments that can change a game, and I think there's not really, from what I've seen of the squads that are, or the 11s that have been named, there's not a slouch in amongst that Tekkers Town team. So it could be, I think, come down to moments, and you know, even the greatest teams in the world can be undone by a moment of individual brilliance, which I think is always likely with Tekkers Town.
Well, you might have been listening to this thinking you didn't know any of the terms that were going out there. But if you feel so inclined, go on YouTube on Saturday probably about 2:30. I think there's a live show from about then, building up to everything that's going to be happening. I think I'm presenting that with the team of people there, including Brian and weirdly Mark Bright and Saunders, who's Spencer's brother, and they'll be pitch side chatting to the players and also getting the insights on, you know, what it's like as an experience on that day. They've sold a lot of tickets. I think 35,000 are now sold in Wembley, which is pretty impressive in the first place. So it's a big event, and there's a lot going on there, and I think it's like Chris was saying earlier, there's something which is experimental about it, which makes it quite interesting, which is maybe why we spent so long talking about it here. And I'll also be commentating on it. So if you do just want to come support us in the first place or see what we're doing with the other spare time that we have, come along and do that. Let's move on to your questions now. Some good questions here. We will start with Luke Dorr, who is BlackShadow179. And he says, if Jack Harrison continues his MLS form into the England under-21s, could we see a new wave of young English players playing abroad. Now, Chris, this is something I meant to ask you earlier in the week about Jack breaking into the England setup here. Thoughts on that in the first place?
I would say deserved, yeah. I think that was the difficulty Jack faced, is that England had watched him for a while, but the problem is that it's a fairly arduous thing to go and see an MLS game, and it requires a decent commitment. So if he didn't perform in that game, you know, it probably reduces his chances. I think he's obviously had a bit of fortune getting in there, but I think honestly it's richly deserved for him. And as much as I like to be objective in these kind of things, having spoken to him and knowing him a little bit, I think he's a great lad, and he'll not be out of place there, I think.
Lovely, that's great. And he obviously is—he's actually a very talented player as well. He's not just—he is here sort of on merit, not just sort of out of experimental, sort of experimenting or having the chance to experiment, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, Luke's question is an interesting one, because I think it raises a good point, which is Jack obviously got the scholarship to go over there, and was at Manchester United in his youth, and I think, if you look at the situation he's put himself in with this career that he's had so far, he's played alongside Frank Lampard, David Villa as a teammate, Pirlo as a teammate. He's playing regular football. You can question the level as much as you like, but he's playing regular football at a fairly decent standard. And so I think at that point, you have to think there'll be other Englishmen who look at that and think, you know what, that appeals to me more than dropping down to League One or League Two and trying to battle my way through things.
Certainly is like, especially if you can go to a great city like New York or LA, or I suppose there's a load of great cities. You can even go to Minnesota, you've probably got a really great, interesting city there. There's lots of interesting places to go in the States. So would your answer be yes, Chris, or do you think that Jack is very much a sort of a one-off in that sense, because we haven't seen that trend being set and he has been over there for quite some time?
I think following the exact same route that he does, or he has, excuse me, I think that will not be repeated.
No.
Because his was more about his life than I'm going to go to America and try and crack it. It was his mum pushing him to do it. Whether we see more Englishmen of his age take to MLS, I think honestly that's already happening. And I've spoken to enough of the guys that organise those trials for college scholarships and such like, who say the standard of player that is now interested is improving year on year.
Nico, how about this? Come to you because you've got a good broad knowledge of Europe. Who do you think will be the top three scorers in Europe? That's from Mark Hardingham.
Top three scorers in Europe this season.
Yeah.
I probably would be inclined to say Cavani will be amongst them.
Even though he's going to be giving away the penalties?
Yes.
Right.
Because, you know, we talked about it last week a little bit. You know, they represent some form of like a Harlem Globetrotters in Liga. And while I don't necessarily completely agree with the comparison, I think they will score a lot of goals. They're a very fun team to watch. So I think Cavani, Kane will definitely be among them. And then I think Ronaldo will be more of an assist season for him. So Messi being, you know, because I think someone wrote something about how he is changing his game a little bit under their new manager. And I think he's going to have another one of those brilliant scoring seasons, as he always does, but possibly even more brilliant than before. So, yeah, those would be my top three: Cavani, Messi, and Harry Kane.
Pretty diverse three as well, in terms of background as well. Stuart Barnes asks you this one, Kristen. What do you make of Harry Redknapp going to Yeovil as an advisor to Darren Way, the manager? As a Yeovil fan, I'm hoping he'll be a big help. Good luck.
I believe he's done this a fair few times. In fact, I think that's how he started at Birmingham, didn't he, as an advisor? It's honestly, I can't say whether it'll be good or bad, because I don't know what advice he's given or in which aspect of the club he is providing that advice. That's the thing.
It's a tricky one, isn't it, in that sense? We don't know exactly what he's doing when he's going into the club, but we haven't necessarily seen an upturn in any club's fortune he's been in fairly recently.
I assume it's not accounting, let's put it that way.
Akshay says, who should Manchester United sign
in the summer, Dybala, Griezmann,
or Bale. Stop signing, please.
Dybala, Griezmann, or Bale. This one goes to you, Hinika. I mean, Dybala seems so like
he,
most excited.
He gave the options of Dybala, Griezmann, or Bale.
Dybala, Griezmann, or Bale, yeah.
Wow, I mean, why would they sign any of those?
That's a really stupid answer, Nico.
Not that they're not good, but like, do they, like Chris said, do they really need more attacking options?
I mean, Griezmann's definitely one that you would say would fit in, but then probably.
What about Rashford?
But he's not, Griezmann's not going to play in off the left, is he? He's going to play behind whoever's up top, which will probably be Lukaku. But then you wonder where Pogba goes.
So you think it'll be a partnership of Lukaku and Griezmann?
I think it'll still be a front one with like, maybe like a floating 10.
Maybe I think the thought with Griezmann would maybe be like reminiscent of that Inter side where he maybe is like more of a winger, and like he puts in a lot of work for Atletico Madrid, so that would be more of a defensive winger, and obviously he has that incredible output but then you're kind of wasting, because he does have an incredible conversion rate, and that is shown to be consistent.
What about then maybe Dybala and
that's what I was about to say, is that I don't think Dybala would work very well in a Mourinho at all. I think I would be surprised if they ever sort of work together in their careers. Because I think he's the type of player that wouldn't thrive under the managerial style, the personal managerial style of someone like Jose Mourinho. Because yeah. I think with Max Allegri, they have taken very special precautions with Dybala and how the way that they treat him. And I think putting him in sort of a volatile situation, you know, with Mourinho, you know, being very, I guess, cold shouldery, depending on the type of performances that you put in. Dybala can be sort of temperamental and inconsistent in the way that he plays. And it requires, I think, more of a, you know, a cliche of, you know, put your arm around him with Max Allegri than it is, you know, perform for me or else or nothing else.
Well, he's not, to be fair, Mourinho has rarely treated the people they've paid massive money for in that way. You know, I mean, maybe.
But Luke Shaw, I mean, he's one of the most expensive defenders that they have.
On the sliding scale of 1 to 89 million, he's a mid spend, really, isn't he now?
Yeah, but I would say that his relationship with players isn't, so he had a falling out with Sergio Ramos and although, yeah, they didn't spend a lot for Iker Casillas, you know, he didn't have a great relationship with him, and he was a really good goalkeeper at the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's more about him, and I would hate to see Dybala under Mourinho, not because I don't like Mourinho. Yeah. I think he's a very good manager, but I don't think it would be a good combination for either of them.
Dybala's also said he wants to build something at Juventus. At least I think he said that the last time he was quoted on it. And then obviously Bale does sort of solve a few problems for them, doesn't he? Because as much as he's been playing on the left, it would mean some sort of positional rotation with the likes of someone like Rashford. Maybe Bale could be put out on the right and do the whole cut-in thing. You know, he's a very focused player.
Yeah, and I think with Bale, especially with the type of injuries that he's been facing, sort of niggling injuries and those things in a rotational Manchester United squad, that could be really beneficial for the longevity of his career. So if he went to Manchester United, you know, he could play in whatever position he wanted to, have more of a free role in a very counter-attacking oriented team, and then get the rest he needs to stay healthy for a year and be really, we could see the best of Bale again in the Premier League, which I think everyone would really want to see.
So go on, who would you?
With that being said, I think Gareth Bale.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. I've got to admit, all three are sort of exciting signings. But Bale, maybe we want Griezmann just because it's been so long. Oh, I don't really know. It's tricky. Bale's probably my choice as well. Can you explain, Kristen, the entire Kroenke Usmanov situation? Is there a real issue, or is it just delusional fans? That's a very barbed question. And the media making the most of it.
Sorry, could you repeat the question? You cut off for a second.
Okay, sure. Are you taking the piss? Can you explain the entire Kroenke Usmanov situation?
From what I understand, one wants to buy the majority of the shares but the other doesn't, because it's a fairly lucrative financial position for him to be in. Because obviously, excuse me, Arsenal are in no danger of being relegated. They finish within the top six, let's say, every season. And so, yeah, that means that he's not necessarily desperate to spend money. I think he has been taking a salary here a number of years as well, of about $3 million. So, yeah, it's clearly financially beneficial for him. I think it's naive to just blame him personally. I think, as with all these types of scenarios, there are a lot of moving parts and actually a lot of blame to be attributed. And I don't think a change of owner suddenly changes the way in which that club operates or elevates them to anything different to what they're in right now.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think a lot of people do just want to capitalize and get some headlines as well, don't they? But that's, I hate to be that cynical. What is, Chris, this is probably another question for you here. What is the secret to London City's dominance this season?
I would say, having watched a number of our games, I would say we've got some really good fast outlets.
Mm-hmm.
Millard, Leroy, really good examples.
Elliot, you're quite
quick across the grass as well. But then I think what's helped us is Aaron coming in and then giving us some stability on the ball alongside the likes of Adam. A regular goalkeeper gives us a bit more structure. And I think in those kind of games, if you can transition really quick, you're always on to a winner, really. And I think the first season, it was just working out the kinks. Whereas this season, we've got a lot more fluency between the lads.
Definitely a lot more fluency in that team. And if you like or watch Next Level Football with Aaron on London City side, you should just know that Aaron is also just a stand-up kid and a really nice guy. And a pleasure to have around the team in the first place. I think he's just a cool guy. I want to pick out a good last question here. This is an interesting one. I know it's usually one question per person, but a secondary question is, what did you all make of Hazard's mimicking of Sterling? We sort of covered this in a previous podcast, but what do you guys make of the sort of players making fun of each other kind of thing? Because Hazard clearly it's clearly Raheem Sterling he's making fun of there, isn't it, Chris?
I mean, it looks like it for all intents and purposes. I don't see anything wrong with it. I think if you've ever been around, because the thing is, he's making fun of his technique.
Yeah.
And I think if you've ever been around footballers at any professional level, whether it's Premier League or conference or whatever, like, they do that shit a lot. Like, they constantly take the piss out of each other, of not just opposition players, but like their own teammates. And also, and it is a very jokey culture. I can see why that is tough for some players, because it can feel like bullying a lot of the time. But yeah, they're constantly ripping the pee out of each other. So I'm not at all surprised to see Hazard do that. And I don't think there's anything offensive in it. And I think I'm not going to lie, I thought it was pretty funny, to be quite frank.
Yeah, it's sort of an unusual one, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people maybe wanted to be outraged by what was going on. But it's very difficult to be. Especially when it's sort of filmed from a distance, it sort of almost looks like some sort of voyeurs filming him through some bushes, which is a little bit unusual as well. It sort of feels a bit like a joke that you weren't meant to be part of. But of course, ultimately, we're all part of that joke at Chelsea. It's been good to have you guys on this week's podcast. Thanks a lot for joining us. If you've got any more questions, we'd love to hear them, and we can integrate them into... We'll probably do another Q&A post-weekend because of the international break, and there's not a lack of headlines, but there certainly is a lot to come. If you want to see us covering something from international football, maybe getting our views on that, we'd be interested to know that as well. And you, of course, can tweet us at The Front Three, or you can tweet us all individually. The ats are in the description. And Chris, if people want to reach you, they can get you on khenage, which is khenage, right?
Correct.
And Nico, or Nick, as we might call you, what would you rather be called, Nico or Nick?
Whatever floats your boat.
Wow. Okay. Where can people get you on Twitter?
They can find me at the front three.
Wow. Okay. Wow. He's really getting into this group thing. You will find Adam and Dave here on the weekend, most probably slash hopefully, and we'll see you again real soon right here on TF3.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.